the day before Thanksgiving, November 25th, 2009, and welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa, and we'll be your geeks in residence for the next hour.
First, we'll look at the latest tech news and happenings in Hawaii and beyond. Then Janie Archuleta will join us to tell us about an upcoming class she's doing on Joomla.
Finally, Benny, Ron, and Sam Joseph from the University of Hawaii will join us to talk about the aquaculture program at UH and how the virtual reality environment of Second Life is enhancing the curriculum. Have your questions ready to call or tweet, but first, the headlines.
An experimental program in Hilo is trying to disrupt the reproductive cycle of invasive nettle moth caterpillar. The caterpillar has sharp, spiky hairs and has been stinging people working with palm plants and other commercially grown ornamentals. Eric Jang, an entomologist with the U.S. Pacific Basin Agricultural Research Center, is pursuing something called mobile mating disruption, backed by both the federal and state departments of agriculture.
Jang plans to use sexually sterilized fruit flies, such as sterilized melon flies, as winged carriers of the scent of nettle moths or nettle moth pheromones. In theory, flies carrying the nettle moth pheromone could be set free in moth-infested locales in Hawaii to widely distribute the scent. Like decoys, the melon flies would create confusion among amorous male moths that use the scent to find female moths.
Sterile melon flies are a logical choice because scientists have already developed techniques for producing large numbers of them to disrupt their normal reproduction and cause their populations to crash. Jang and his colleagues have worked on the concept for several years. Former postdoctorate research associate Matthew Siderhaus identified and synthesized the nettle moth pheromone compound in early experiments funded by the Agricultural Research Center and the Hawaii Invasive Species Council. Now, this is, of course, an interesting strategy to sort of decoy a female in the form of a fruit fly, mm-hmm. and sort of let the nettle moths think that...
Just chase them around.
Just chase them around.
Sounds like a bad day for
the
moth.
Now, the curious thing is, you know, will the nettle moth even recognize the fact that, you know, they perhaps mated with, you know, not a successful species, and would they try again to find another female? But it must mean that they've tried and, you know, they've kind of gone on.
Well, I mean, I think that's the point of the experiment. It's not, you know, this is their revolutionary new idea. And I would imagine that if a geographic area is covered with these pheromones, that it's pretty much useless to find a mate. I mean, I think that's pretty much the idea. I hadn't seen these nettle moth caterpillars before, but they are, you know, they're very spiky. I guess kids step on them in yards now. They've only been in Hawaii for less than a decade. They first entered the islands through Hilo in 2001 from Taiwan. And now they're on Oahu and the Big Island at least.
I've seen these caterpillars. And I'm not sure if they're the nettle moth caterpillar, but they are red and they have little spikes on them.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of curious.
But, you know, mobile mating disruption, if it works for these nettle moths, maybe then we can try them on teenagers.
I think that's a good idea.
Much has been said about the health benefits of omega-3 fatty acids, which are most commonly found in fish. But a new study suggests that those benefits vary depending on a person's ethnicity, which in turn points to the method of fish preparation as a key factor in how healthy fish can be. Li Xing Meng, a doctoral candidate at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, found that the benefits were particularly strong for men and that the types of fish consumed were important. Wild salmon and tuna are high in omega-3 fatty acids.
People who ate baked or boiled fish had lower rates of coronary heart disease mortality, but those eating deep-fried, salted, or dried fish actually had higher mortality rates. The only method of frying fish that seemed protective was stir-frying, usually primarily used by Japanese. Meng said it appears that boiling or baking fish in low-sodium shoyu and tofu is beneficial, while eating fried, salted, or dried fish is not. In fact, these methods of preparation may contribute to your risk.
Men who ate the most fish saw up to a 23% reduction in heart disease, with the strongest effects observed in white, Japanese, and Latino men. Women saw some similar benefits from fish, but there were also clear heart health benefits for women who consumed greater amounts of shoyu and tofu. The study was based on the multi-ethnic cohort study, which tracked over 180,000 people in Hawaii and California for more than a decade. Meng reported her findings at the annual meeting of the American Heart Association, which took place in Orlando, Florida.
Now, it's interesting that women had an additional benefit, and they think that might have been due to these phytoestrogens mm-hmm. that were in shoyu and tofu that added to the omega-3.
Well, I think the soy element, you know, the soybean element in shoyu was key to the omega-3 thing. And actually, it was just a week ago that I think it's Monsanto that does genetic engineering says that they are working on a soybean oil that's made to have higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids as well. So rather than trying to convince people to eat more fish, that you could prepare foods using this oil instead to get some of those benefits. Unfortunately, though, you know, certainly genetic engineering can make some people nervous as well.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, so it sounds like they want to combine all those benefits of the soybean as well as the fish into one modified soybean.
Right. But I thought it was also interesting. I mean, certainly we can guess that fried or salted fish is worse for you. But in this case, even if it was a fish that was high in omega-3 acids, it could overwhelm any benefits and make it worse for you, up to a 12 to 15% increase if you eat that kind of fish.
Mm-hmm. Next up, regular beachgoers in Hawaii are probably familiar with the regular arrival of box jellyfish. But scientists at the University of Hawaii are part of an international team that is now developing or beginning to unravel the evolutionary relationships among the various species of box jellyfish, thereby providing some insight into their toxicity. Alan Collins, a researcher with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, said by determining the relationship among the different box jellyfish, some of which are capable of killing healthy humans, the study can help in the future development of antivenoms and treatments for their stings.
Using DNA extracted from tissue samples, the researchers used a number of genetic tests and analytical techniques to trace the evolution of the various species and their toxicity and to sort out misidentified species. The three-year study looked at dozens of specimens in collections around the world. Collins, who began studying the evolutionary links of box jellyfish more than a decade ago, said, "Knowing who is related to whom among the box jellyfish will be very helpful in making predictions about species that are not well known."
With this research, scientists will now be able to make more informed choices about organisms for future venom studies and make predictions on which species are likely to be a public health concern. Box jellyfish, is also called sea wasp or stingers or fire jellies, live primarily in warm coastal waters around the world. They are particularly well known in Hawaii, Australia, and the Philippines, and the rest of Southeast Asia. There are about 50 different species, some with 10-foot-long tentacles. Now, the interesting thing is Angel Yanagihara, who is very much a part of this, and she's with the University of Hawaii and the organization that actually did the study for Hawaii. And she and her partner, Alan Collins, were doing a lot of the study here, and in fact, you know, many back in 1997, and they were the ones that provided the specimens that were part of this worldwide study that sort of helped them link the different species amongst these other species that were located across the globe. So that was pretty interesting.
Well, you know, the Australian one is the one that's the most deadly, and it can, you know, it can kill even a healthy human. It was interesting that the study also found that jellyfish tend to be isolated geographically, and they don't tend to cross open ocean habitats. But certainly Australia is close enough to Hawaii, I think, that certainly reason to be nervous. But definitely a good study, definitely something that anyone who swims regularly is familiar with. I don't remember it being as big of a concern as it is now, though.
Well, you bring up a good point because, you know, when I was growing up, I heard much more about Portuguese man of war. Mm-hmm. So I asked Angel, what is the, occurrence of box jellyfish, and is this something new? And she said, you know, box jellyfish have been around for 6 million years. It's just a question of how much more populated there are depending on the other environments that affect their populations, like vertebrates. So fishes, and I guess as vertebrates decline, the invertebrates increase in population.
Right.
So I think that's why we see more box jellyfish now.
Well, I'm certain the changes in the temperature of water is also key too, but I find it fascinating. I mean, the study of jellyfish is difficult because they're not the most substantial creatures, so they don't exactly leave big fossils or bones anywhere to study. So very interesting stuff. Geologists have some surprising news for spelunkers and other explorers of caves and lava tubes. Sometimes colorful deposits that have long been presumed to be ordinary minerals are often mats of waste excreted by previously unknown types of microbes. The discovery, scientists say, could offer clues in the search for life on Mars and beyond. Penelope Boston at the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology told National Geographic, "We're finding that you need to look at things you might write off as not being biological. They might be biological.
The microbes were found on walls of lava tubes in Hawaii, New Mexico, and the Portuguese Azores Islands, a volcanic archipelago in the Atlantic Ocean. The Hawaii deposits were described as lovely blue-green ooze dripping out of the cave ceiling. In the Azores, the deposits form bright pink hexagons or orange spots. In New Mexico, they look like swirls of gold rope. Boston and her colleagues have been seeking out these unusual deposits since 1994 and putting them under a microscope and testing them for DNA.
These discoveries add to a growing body of evidence that lava tubes on other planets might be the best place to look for signs of extraterrestrial life. Pictures from a Mars orbiter analyzed in 2007 show dark holes that appear to be places where lava tube roofs have collapsed. Scientists hypothesize that ancient water could have seeped into subterranean caves, carrying minerals that could have fed microbes, and these caves could help preserve any possible Martian fossils.
Now, that's pretty fascinating. I mean, just looking at the caves here and the kinds of deposits that the organisms left, I mean, it is very colorful, very
bright.
It is very bright, but they definitely look organic.
Yeah, they didn't. I'm not sure if I would necessarily think that they were minerals, but in any case, they've definitely confirmed that, as Diana Northrup, who led this study at the University of Mexico, says, it's bug poop, basically, these colorful deposits that people go and travel to some of these caves to admire. That's what you're dealing with. But the tie to Mars, I think, is very key, because there was also just earlier this month, I think, additional information on the NASA and the Northern Illinois University said that they feel that there's strong evidence that there was a large ocean on Mars at one point. People are still hypothesizing how those valleys got there, and they're finding more evidence of water movement. And even though it's all gone from the surface, that's true when we have lava tubes, but there could be a lot of moisture and there could be a lot of microbes that are still there.
And, in lava tubes, you would have the mixture of the elements and energy, perhaps from, lava or eruptions that could perhaps create an environment for microbial growth. So it makes sense that the energy and the food resources are there inside these environments like lava tubes.
Now we just got to get to Mars.
And that's it for the news. And now joining us in the studio is Janie Archuleta, and she's here to tell us about an upcoming Pacific New Media class on Joomla. Welcome to the show, Janie.
Thank you for having me.
So for starters, maybe you can tell us a little bit about Joomla. And basically, that's an application for content management. And why is it so popular that, a class needs to be put on for it? I mean, are there a lot of people interested in it?
Yes, there's actually a lot of web content management systems out there. There's Drupal, WordPress, Joomla. My favorite's Joomla. As you know, open source software is very popular. It's free software that's published out there, and it's free to people to download and to use. And so they have a lot of stuff out there. My favorite, I'm sure you've downloaded like Norton Antivirus, and usually pay $30 or $40 for that. They have clamav.net, and that's a free antivirus. That's how I sort of explain to people this is open source software. It's equivalent to free software where you're not paying commercial prices. So Joomla is a web content management system. I'm sure you've heard of CMS, which is content management. So basically, when you get a collection of procedures and you use it to manage your workflow for collaboration, this is basically what it is. You're getting your published HTML pages, and you're allowing editors to submit their content without technical knowledge of HTML or uploading files.
Yeah, I've used WordPress quite a bit. We do deploy Joomla at my day job, where we build websites for realtors. And basically, that's what it is. It's a simpler interface, whereas before, when you wanted to build a website, you'd have to hire some geek, perhaps
right.
like Bert, to build that site.
Well, like Ryan.
And now you would. There is some technical know-how involved in setting up a Joomla site, but then you can hand the keys over and say, hey, you want to change that picture, you want to update your address, you just log in and make that change whenever you like. So what is the target audience of the class that you'll be teaching for Pacific New Media?
This will be more on the user end, where they can create and publish articles. I'll also be teaching part of the administration, which is creating menus, creating modules and components, and using the global tools. We might go into installation, and as you know, Joomla is PHP on the front end, and on the back end, it's MySQL.
So that's the database that it runs on.
Right.
Which are also free programming languages and free technologies. Okay. Well, obviously the appeal of something that's free is important to everybody. You mentioned modules. What is a Joomla module? Do you program a Joomla module, or can you just go out and grab someone else's Joomla module?
Actually, the modules are created within Joomla. One of my favorites is the wrapper module. You could actually take a Google Calendar, take the code from the calendar and put it in the wrapper and publish that on your website. So you get the functionality of other sources that you can put in your own website.
So for a user who's contemplating whether they want to use WordPress or Joomla, what would be the characteristics of a project that would point them more in the Joomla direction than perhaps with a WordPress implementation?
You know, I like all three. I know Drupal, I've read about Drupal, and that's more of a social media, if you want to put a lot more social media on that one. WordPress and Joomla are more content driven. So if you have a lot of content, you have a lot of articles, this is a good one to use. And of course, you have all your modules. You could use your RSS feeds. There's just so many in there that you can use. And it's if you're a database and you like databases and the way that's organized, that's sort of the way it's organized on the back end.
Now, have you work with Joomla, though? I mean, you deploy sites in Joomla. What is an example of a Joomla site? Are we talking a news site? Are we talking a business website, a shopping cart site?
You know, I think it's great to start off a Joomla site if you're a nonprofit organization or you're starting off your business and you don't have the money to buy a commercial software, because it's so expensive out there, especially for web content management. There's huge companies like Vignette, and these companies, they go up to $50,000 or $60,000. So this is like your free source. And as you know, free source is supported by community contributors, programmers, developers, and even large companies. So I would think for a new business or nonprofit organization or a church, something that's where you don't spend too much money on it.
You would still need some degree of support in order to, let's say, get technical help on this. How would you suggest people proceed in terms of you know, trying to find the right resources?
I think good resources are, if, let's say you're going to start a new website for your church, you can, your members, there has to be web developers in your organization or even nonprofit organizations. And all the information is online. So mm-hmm. there's free videos, free quick steps on how to install. All your resources are available to you. The only difference between open source and a commercial software is commercial software, you need to pay for support and you need to call. With Joomla, you don't. You can download the free information. You can go online and get support from other users and forums.
And there's a pretty strong local community that I think you even help organize on TechHUI.
Yes. I started a new Joomla TechHUI support group. So we're about a couple of members and we kind of help each other out. So It just started, so you're welcome to join, and we all kind of exchange information. And if you get stuck somewhere, we're happy to help you.
Great. So tell us when and where is the class that you're going to be teaching?
It's going to be at the University of Hawaii, Pacific New Media, and it's going to be December 5th on a Saturday from 9 to 4. And I'll be going over how to organize and plan your site, and we'll be going over menus, modules and sections, and adding even extensions to your Joomla. So you could actually have it in different languages also.
That'll be great.
Where's the best place to check this out on the web?
Yes, on the University of Hawaii Pacific New Media website.
Okay, sounds good. And that's our news for today. And we want to thank Janie for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's what's been happening this week. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll have Benny Ron and Sam Joseph from the University of Hawaii here to talk about aquaculture.
What opportunities are there for aquaculture here in Hawaii, and how can the virtual real estate of Second Life help teach about the practice? Stay with us and find out, and if you have a question or comment, call us at 941-3689 or toll-free from the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689.
And you can also tweet us your questions at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from PowSpam, a locally owned company providing email filtering, secure data storage, and archiving services. More at powspam.net.
Percussionist and recording artist Von Baron plays the Atherton this Saturday at 7:30, featuring Mark Tenoy on bass, Jeff Peterson on guitar, Dan Del Negro on piano, and Tim Sukiyama on sax. They'll be playing a concert that Baron says will be a mixture of jazz, pop, and new age on steroids. That's Von Baron in concert in the Atherton. Tickets available at the door.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu office of Grant Thornton and audit and advisory partner Patrick Oki, specializing in audit, tax, and advisory services. On the web at grantthornton.com.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. Tonight we'll explore the aquaculture program at the University of Hawaii and the current state of aquaculture here in the state. And we invite you to join the conversation. Call us at 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands with your comments or questions.
And joining us today in the studio is Benny Ron and Sam Joseph, both from the University of Hawaii. I want to welcome you both to Bite Marks Cafe.
Aloha.
Now, you know, Benny, you're becoming a very familiar voice here, and we wanted to have you come back and tell us a little bit more about, you know, the aquaculture program, because this is a relatively new program at the university, and, you know, there's a lot of attention being placed on it. So maybe you can give us sort of the broad overview of what the interest level is at the University of Hawaii in aquaculture.
Okay, University of Hawaii decided that it's going to be a mission, the future mission, knowing that there is a major decline in fisheries, a major decline in fish in the oceans. We know what's happening right now all over the world. And the university has decided that so many people already interested in aquaculture, so many people are already working in aquaculture in various schools at the university, at different departments and so forth. And there is a major need for it when it comes to the industry to create aquaculture program for the whole system and to bring in an aquaculture coordinator for the whole system, and on top of it, to start a graduate program that was never there as a system-wide graduate program for master and PhD.
So the aquaculture program in and of itself is an interdisciplinary program. I mean, it sort of spans a number of different departments. I mean, could you give me an example of what departments it pulls from?
Right. That's the major thing that the Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education, Gary Ostrander, had in mind is to have an interdisciplinary sort of institute that will home many of the people and the department that are working together. This is a future thing, hopefully, that will come up soon. And you can find today aquaculture as far as UH Hilo, and there are people also at community colleges interested in. You can find them in CTAR. You can find them at Coconut Island, you know, HIMB. That means SOES, the School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology, Zoology Department, where I got my PhD years ago. Mm-hmm. And so forth, and also even the engineering department. Now the idea is to start working together.
Now, I was, you know, not clear necessarily on aquaculture as a general field. I mean, you mentioned fisheries, but I also know that it has to do with agriculture, obviously. What pops into mind most frequently is like hydroponics, where you're dealing with plants that grow without soil, for example. But when you say aquaculture as a means to help with sustainability and the greater direction, could you explain just a little more basically what that entails? I mean, what is the value of aquaculture itself?
Well, the value of aquaculture, if you talk about the definition, is very wide. It's basically everything that you grow in water can and cultivate it is aquaculture. So basically, it engulfs almost anything that you do. It either it's plant or organism like fish and so forth. So now it's related to what you heard lately about aquaponics. When you can incorporate both of them, you have creatures in the water, and the nutrients, the minerals that are coming out of their waste is being used by the plants. The plants are picking them up and basically filtering the water, and the water can go back to the organism like fish and so forth.
You know, in terms of aquaculture, you know, Hawaii, just from traditional times, have used fish ponds as ways of cultivating fish. I mean, so there are some very traditional means of employing principles of aquaculture. I'm curious to maybe understand, have there been lessons learned from traditional methods of aquaculture and employing them in some of the modern sort of technologies in today's world?
Definitely. The more I learn about the ancient Hawaiian fish ponds, the more respect I have to those ancient guys, you know, the ancestors of today's Hawaiians. It's amazing how they knew the right location to put them together, the combination with seawater and fresh water, and understanding how to build the walls and so forth. And it appears that for years the aquaculture was going into intensive culture, and now we're learning that it doesn't have to be so in various occasions. So I think Hawaii, definitely, we need to work together with nature, more in harmony, and try to figure out how is the best way to do it without affecting the environment. And I think this example of Hawaiian fish ponds and all the terra fields that they had in the, you know, the Hapua and so forth, and this is one of the directions that we are interested in employing and getting into the system.
Now, Benny, you talked a lot about how cross-disciplinary this is and how it might cross different interests and different boundaries on the University of Hawaii campus. And Sam, you know, it sounds to me that you bring in a lot of the technical side, a lot of the online and computer side. I mean, Benny might be speaking more to the aquaponics and getting your hands dirty, but how do you fit into this picture, and what are some of the overall things that you're trying to bring into the aquaculture program?
Sure, yeah. So I'm kind of from a computer science background, and I didn't really know about aquaponics at all until, you know, I got accosted by Benny. And he invited me down to the Olamana Gardens. I believe you had Glenn Martinez on before, and that was a fascinating tour a couple of months back, and I saw all about how these systems work. And what we've been doing is working with different kinds of technologies, virtual worlds like Second Life, mobile applications like that on the iPhone, social technologies like Ning, in order to try and realize Benny's vision of, you know, Hawaii as the aquaculture hub. So we've rebuilt an aquaponics farm in, you know, 3D Second Life, that's now available for everybody to come and see. And we're doing the same thing sort of in the iPhone and on the Ning website, where we're trying to map all of the aquaponics activity all around the globe and make that available to everybody so they can see where, you know, aquaponic resources are nearby and fit that all together.
Now, we've talked about Second Life previously, and we had just sort of said anecdotally that someone has built a replication of the University of Hawaii campus in the Second Life environment. And that's you, from what I understand?
I am the currently the administrator of the University of Hawaii Second Life campus. And it was actually created for a number of grants that we had for different projects related to neo-geography. Those grants have since finished, but we still have the island, and we've thrown that open for use by all UH staff, student, and faculty. And I guess built it, of course, when you pay Linden Labs for these things, they provide you an island. We've worked with designers, taking photos of the UH campus combined with Google Maps, and they've given us, you know, their best replica of a portion of the Southeast campus.
You know, we're talking to Sam Joseph and Benny Ron, both from University of Hawaii and the aquaculture curriculum. And, you know, if you have any questions or comments, you want to feel free to give us a call. And the number here is 941-3689, and from the Neighbor Islands at 877-941-3689. And a question that I had for you, Sam, is that, you know, in terms of curriculum and teaching people about aquaculture, What is it about Second Life that adds to that experience that perhaps just a regular classroom environment could or could not deliver?
I think the thing that Second Life offers here is the ability to produce a 3D model. As you may know, aquaculture, it's kind of almost like a fundamental thing. They've been doing it for thousands and thousands of years. It's so completely separate. It's sort of a fundamental human activity. And it's really, you know, to understand it, you've got to get in there, like I went down to Olamana Gardens, and see the water flowing around and see the fish and see the plants. Now, not everybody, you know, has the chance to get down to Olamana Gardens, particularly if they're, you know, not in Hawaii. With the Second Life, it's still not a replacement for the real thing. But, you know, we can create it. It's kind of the closest we can get with the current computer technology to show people, you know, okay, here is the flow of the system. You can get in there with the fish. You can get in there and see the plants. The initial build that we've done is kind of a relatively static build, but that's just the first phase, because now this whole system will become a simulation. So you start to play with the pumps and the size of the pipes and the layout, and then we start to see the plants, you know, grow or, you know, die away. And then it moves from beyond just being kind of a publicity tool to say, look at this exciting thing, look at what's going on with aquaculture and aquaponics, and it becomes a research tool and a teaching tool. People can get a, you know, sort of a semi hands-on feel for how these systems work without having to leave the comfort of their own home.
You know, Benny, in terms of some of the courses that get taught in aquaculture, what is it that would typically be taught in the classroom, and in your mind, what would be typically taught in a, let's say, virtual environment?
Well, let me start and complete what Sam was already talking about. And we want to look for a moment at the big view, okay? As an educator, we all ask ourselves, what is the most important thing? Is to get the attention of the students. Now, today, on a regular big hall, and you all were students, imagine yourself sitting in a big hall with a big board, and we have a 200 or 300 students sitting there, and then the lecturer is going there and start using the chalk and writing a formula, and then you forget, oh, I have to change here. What happened to the attention of the student? He already lost them. They do Twitter, they do Facebook, they do everything possible. Within 1 hour, they can visit at least 20 friends on Facebook and so forth, uh-huh. And do maybe 100 tweeting. So what I'm fighting for is 100% attention, and that's what I'm telling Sam. I said, Sam, do whatever you do. I want all the attention in aquaculturehub.org, which is reaching all over the world. You probably heard of aquaculturehub.org. Right. This is being a cutting edge in terms of technology. It uses Ning platform along with Google, you know, gadgets. You know, just look at the map that Sam is developing now, and he can elaborate on that. Facebook and Twitter widgets with the We widgets complement by Second Life presence. I mean, come on. We want 100% attention. Now, when you talk about classes, you can have any kind of class on Second Life, because I can, for example, if you go to Genome Island on Second Life, you're going to find genetics questions and the makeup of cells and how to put chromosomes together. And you can give tasks to the students, and they can go back into various online classes. And my vision is the next program we're going to have will be totally online everywhere in the world. The University of Hawaii and Hawaii, I would like them to be the center of the world and to have a huge ripple effect all over the world, using our aloha spirit, give everything almost free, and we're going to get back a tsunami of goodwill.
So you mentioned Aquaculture Hub, and Aquaculture Hub is really a place where, for the most part, anybody can join.
Correct.
And then you mentioned Ning, and then for our listeners who are not familiar with Ning, that's like a social network environment where anybody can come in, set up a profile, and join the group and have a discussion, create a blog, forums, post videos and photos. But in terms of the Aquaculture Hub, you're extending this to anybody who's interested in aquaculture. So you're looking at promoting it across the globe.
That's true.
How has the reception for that been?
It's amazing, because we have people from all over the world. We have people from Turkey. We have people from Greece. We have people from Panama. We have people from South America. Aquaculture Hub is not just for scientists, not just for students. It is for everyone interested in aquaculture. I think really we want to have people coming in, putting everything in. For example, I had this bus tour, you know, the aquaponic bus tour. Right after that, the farmers in the Big Island went on Aquaculture Hub and were uploading all the photos from our trip. You can go there and see the trip. And they were thrilled. They loved it.
Now, when you say that it's open to everyone, where is the point of entry for somebody who has a backyard, has a gardening or a green thumb or just some interest? I mean, we've spoken to groups like Kanu Hawaii and other organizations in Hawaii that are very devoted to sustainability and being environmentally conscious. So are these resources directed at those people? I mean, I have a backyard and I'm interested in growing some fish and working with that. Can we use these same resources?
You can use these resources. If you even just have a little aquarium at home, you can do that. I'm doing aquaponics in my own office on the 7th floor in the Biomed building, okay, with a little aquarium and a few plants. So even if you just want to read about it or you just want to interact with people, come on and be our friend. And we are connected to Facebook. We are connected to Twitter. We are all over the place.
Well, certainly trying to take someone's full attention and keep it is a significant goal, particularly with today's college student. Now, Sam, you showed us briefly the aquaponics farm on the virtual University of Hawaii campus. It's on the lawn of the virtual post building,
right.
Although except instead of Dole Street, it's now an ocean over there. But but I'm curious about what that environment does for somebody who wants to learn about aquaculture, because like you said, it does involve the movement of water and fish and, you know, how it's a physical system.
Right.
So what are the opportunities for someone to manipulate these elements and do a study? You know, if you can't go to Olomana Farms, but you do want to see what happens if you move this, you know, trough somewhere
right.
else or position it somewhere else, is that conducive? Is that something that Second Life supports, that level of intricacy?
I think it is. And I think it's, you know, you've kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's the ability to manipulate these things. You know, a group of students being shown around a real life aquaponics farm are unlikely to be allowed to tinker with it to their heart's content. But you know, with the aquaculture farm in Second Life, they can do just that. One of the things that I've noticed, I think you know, opportunities for education. There's kind of a smaller building block, which is, you know, effective collaboration, just even between pairs of people within a space. We've been doing a lot of work, you know, in pairs, in threes within Second Life. And the interesting thing, you know, things that are just on Skype, on a phone call, where you're kind of saying, oh, well, this thing needs to be above that, and so on. If you can be pointing to the thing that you're referring to as you're talking about it, suddenly everything is resolved, just as it would be in a face-to-face communication. And so, for example, in the main filtration tank in the, you know, aqua farm, we've got this valve, and the way this valve works with the vacuum and so on. And you can see here we are on radio, and I'm stuck. How do I explain? You know, the water goes up, and then it creates this vacuum, and it goes down. Doing that, you know, in Second Life, and every Wednesday, in fact, I'm in the campus center in my role as Second Life evangelist, and I, you know, I have people come up past the campus center in University of Hawaii, Manoa, and I show them this, and I kind of move things up and down. Whether they're, I'm showing it to them on a big screen or I'm meeting them remotely. Somebody from Washington State was in there today, and I was showing it to them then. You know, you have this spark of understanding, and I think it's those collaborative components that then build to allow the broader educational experience.
Now, I'm starting to twist my brain. When you're in campus center as the evangelist, you're talking about you're physically in the real campus center.
That's the real thing. Yeah, doing kind of outreach there. What we've done is, you know, to make it just to really let people know that it's free for everybody on the UH campus to use, is we put up a big screen and we project the thing. And so I've been running these tours purely in Second Life for a long time, and I thought, how can we get more people? So I now run them in parallel, both in Second Life and in real life, and I have an audience who appear in Second Life and in real life, and it is pretty mind twisting, I have to say.
So we want you to hold that thought, because we want to talk a little bit more about this. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Benny Ron and Sam Joseph.
Call us at 941-3689 or from the Neighbor Islands at 877-941-3689. Have you got a backyard that's just screaming for some aquaculture? You can ask the experts on our show. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Well, coming up is Thanksgiving, and as always, we will be on tape on Thursday. We will have a show for you talking about green gifts. We'll take a look at what you might want to get for those you love that fits your pocketbook, that also fits your ethics. Next time on Town Square, green gifts, Thursday at 5, and happy Thanksgiving.
Gently use LPs, CDs, and DVDs for the Almost New Music Sale, along with donations for the annual book sale, are now being accepted at the Friends of the Library Warehouse in Kaka'ako. Information at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. And we're talking to Benny Ron and Sam Joseph from the University of Hawaii about aquaculture. If you've got a question, we have the experts here to answer. You can call us at 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor island.
And, you know, right before the break, we were talking a little bit about doing something in real life in Campus Center and then actually recreating that in Second Life. And the interesting thing to me is that it's kind of neat to position real life and Second Life, but then how do you actually create the experience in Second Life that is, let's say, changeable, manipulated, to actually convey the lesson, you know, in Second Life that you would have liked to do in real life? And how do you actually program that to occur?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And I think when I show people how this works in Campus Center, they're kind of like, oh, wow. Because I think a lot of people, you know, the impression of Second Life is that still going on? Is whatever. When you show people, I think the build tools, mm-hmm. and they are, I think, very intuitive. A lot of people talk about how Second Life is kind of it's difficult to learn how to use. And maybe if you haven't grown up doing 3D computer games, then it is, you know, not necessarily an intuitive interface. But I think the build portion of the interface, where basically you can select an object and you say edit, and then it shows you arrows and you can move that object up and down, you know, with a couple of different key presses, you can rotate the object, you can resize the object, you can give it different textures. You can basically, a bit like a Lego kit, you can build from scratch anything that you want. You know, it gets progressively more and more complex. And there are now people whose entire businesses are that they're designers for Second Life. They're landscapers. They, you know, these people work and they get paid real money, not just the Linden dollars of the Second Life account. I must mention that, using these building tools, so this summer we had one full course from the College of Education. Professor Peter Leong taught his instructional design for virtual worlds and worked through exactly that with his group of 12 graduate students. How do you, using these basic building tools, put together actually instructional modules? And we have a series of examples on the campus actually created by those graduate students of the instructional modules that they built for language learning, for, you know, multimedia design and so forth.
So now, you bring up a good point. I mean, ultimately, you do not want to create more people who can program for Second Life. You want to create people that are going to go out there with aquaculture skills, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I know that it's still in the beginning, so you mm-hmm. want to do a lot of the development and programming and build out the environment. But what are the transferable skills once you have that environment built out so that they can now become competent aquaculturalists?
I think the key thing is probably conceptual. At the moment, you know, the extent that we've taken the build, what people can really gain is a conceptual grasp of, like, oh, okay, this kind of thing. Although, you know, how critical that is, if someone's already decided that they want to build an aquaculture system, they've probably got the concept. I think it's a question of the next stage is moving it into a real detailed simulation. So, you know, in the same way that we talked about, a group of students couldn't just play around with a running, you know, aqua farm in most cases. Similarly, a person who's, you know, started building an aqua farm in their backyard is, you know, going to maybe cautious about making certain sorts of changes. Are you going to kill the fish? Are you going to, you know, are the plants going to thrive? you know, ultimately, and this is a little bit in the future, I think, but, you know, a full 3D simulation allows you to test, you know, possible changes that you might make to the system before you have to do them in real life. And it's the same. I mean, this is really replicating the process that we have in our own heads. Usually before most things, we think about, you know, how's that going to work? Complex systems like aquafarms, you know, if you can actually simulate that, particularly in a 3D, in a sort of accessible way, then that's a really valuable skill. You know, ultimately, you know, with enough experience, you've internalized that, and the, you know, experienced farmers like Glenn Martinez are not going to need these kinds of things.
Right. But, yeah. Now, Benny, I know that you're very excited about these online tools and all the different ways that you can spread the word online. But I'm curious, you know, coming from the educational side and coming from working in the field, what are some of the things that you would see as the requirement to be in the real world, to go away from the to go away from the virtual side? And these are just some things that you need to do in the real world.
That's a very important point that you're bringing up, because and that's why I, by the way, I used social media, because you wouldn't, most of the aquaculture or educational websites for universities are informational. And then I, after studying what I want, I said, no, I'm going to go on social media from day one. So I want to connect people. And when, and then actually, after the people already connected via the, you know, the virtual world or via the media that we have, like Facebook and Ning and so forth, people getting together and they become friends on you know, on the World Wide Web, and then they become friends for real, and then they teach each other. And then this is where we have hands-on experience, because the hands-on experience is very valuable. You cannot replace it, because eventually you're not going to eat the fish in Second Life.
Right.
I don't know how they taste. Maybe that's going to be the next challenge for Sam. But what important is, I want to connect the people that usually did not know about each other, and they didn't have even the opportunity to know that there is somebody around the corner. Now, when they get together, now we can go do the job. Now we can do workshops. And so I want to see many, many workshops going, people coming, like the workshop we're talking about in the August 17th to the 20th on the Big Island, and UHilo going to be a major player on that, is to bring people from all over the world and from Australia to Hawaii, and then learn together, and then we're going to go again on a bus tour. Mm-hmm. So definitely you cannot replace that component, and I have no intention to replace it.
You know, we're talking to Benny Ron and Sam Joseph, both of UH and the aquaculture program there. And if you have a question or comment, you can call us at 941-3689 or from the neighbor islands at 1-877-941-3689. And we have Pat, who has been patiently waiting on the line from Lanai. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Yeah, aloha. Thanks. Well, I've been listening to this, and it seems like a lot of your access, you have to be a UH student, and maybe I missed that. How do people from the outside begin to learn about this and access the programs from the from a computer?
Okay, great question, Pat.
Excellent.
Benny, maybe you can answer that, because I know this is open to everybody, right?
It is open. Pat, thank you for calling, and it's open to everyone. And I mentioned it, and I'm going to mention it again. The farmers, the bottom line is that they are feeding us. So the people who actually create the aquaculture with the both with hands and in the backyard or in the industry, without them, we are nothing. But we want to provide them the connection and the opportunity to know that there are workshops, that there are other people who are doing things. To you can go on the website and learn and see what's happening. And then all the events are published over there. So we want to create an opportunity to meet and to learn from each other and to share the knowledge. Now, all these electronic devices and electronic ways and waves are just to connect us and to make sure you, Pat, will be able to come up and meet us, and or we come to your place and meet you, and we learn together from each other.
Now, Sam, you talked about the Second Life environment. For example, I don't need to be a UH student to come and check out what you're doing. And from what I recall, Second Life doesn't – it's still free to use.
It is still free. And, yes, we have the entire island public. Anybody can come there. If you want to do building and fun stuff, then, you know, you need to talk to us. But we're certainly open to, you know, whatever proposals people have. But it is – yeah. And the same, aquaculturehub.org is also free, and anybody can sign up. And as Benny says, we're just looking to make connections between people.
So is definitely the hub of this conversation because that's where some of the expertise is. But Benny, can you tell us a little bit about what kind of involvement you're seeing or cooperation? You mentioned farms that participate. I mean, how big is this overall passion for aquaculture outside of the University of Hawaii?
Oh, it's all over the place. And everybody today, and also the media is helping a lot. We're talking about the media, the radio, the TV, movies, the internet, of course, are telling everybody, look, there is a real problem with the environment. There's a real problem with fisheries. We need to do something. So everybody aware that probably aquaculture will be the next solution, and it has to be sustainable and it has to be responsible. Now, how we do that? So the first step is to connect the people, and then we work together. We don't come and say we have all the solutions, but we say let's work together. So the question is, are you want to sit on the fence or you want to take action and do it? We want to give you the opportunity. So we're working with many, many, many other people around the world, and they're willing to step in.
And I think to add to that, well, one of the things we're trying to do through aquaculturehub.org is, you know, track all of those people. And so this is the neo-geographical component. We have you know, data that we're collecting in aquaculturehub.org, and you know, there's a Google Map widget in there that shows, you know, everybody that we know, and we're trying to add to that and build that up as a resource so you can find who's nearby, what resources are available to you. And using Google and Yahoo Pipes, we're also pulling that into an iPhone application, which we now have in prototype, hope to release early next year. So, you know, as Benny has mentioned to me before, some of the aquaculture farmers, they may not have, you know, a good computer, but they may well have an iPhone. So, you know, with this app, you can, you know, go to your immediate location. It'll show you, you know, are your neighbors doing aquafarms and so on. And again, it's all about connecting the people, and there are literally hundreds and thousands of people all over the world working on this kind of thing, and I think it's ripe for connecting those people together.
So you've got a specific or a single database of geographical places where this activity is happening, whether it's someone in their backyard or a commercial farm, and you can see this on the iPhone, on the website, and other elements of this. Have either of you seen already sort of a kismet, sort of accidental, like, oh, well, you know, if it wasn't for the online component of this, I wouldn't have known that right down the street was somebody that's doing the exact same thing, and he's already figured out how to keep the fish fine in this climate, for example?
Definitely. And you can see that people come up with all these gadgets that they made in the farm using all sort of piping or using, you know, the toilet floater and stuff like that. And they just showing it on the pictures. Hey, look what I've done. And everybody, oh, wow, we need that. We need that. On the other hand, we just got yesterday pictures from Cobia Farm from Panama. With a really nice of Michael Arbus to send the pictures and said, look what we got, look what we do, and show his fears also, you know, like similar to what Bill Spencer had in mind and so forth. So suddenly people come in from all over the world, said, look what we do, and share the knowledge. That's exactly what we need. We give opportunities.
So this is very, very interesting because it's much more than the curriculum out of UH. It's really creating what you're calling the aquaculture hub, which connects a lot of people, not only in this local community, but worldwide. And you were mentioning earlier that this conference that you're putting together in August is a conference that's bringing people from all over the world to come to Hawaii and look at some of the things that are being done here. And of course, you'll probably encourage them to join Aquaculture Hub and, you know, and let them know about Second Life and all that. So your vision of bringing all these people together and creating that synergy, I mean, how is it coming along? Are you getting the critical mass?
Yes. Well, critical mass will be when we have everybody. But to me, as I said, I want to have 100% attention, no
I
less.
See.
So I'll tell you, you'll know that when you get it. But the fact that you are there already and others, it means a lot because it creates something. People say, hey, maybe I'm missing something, right? And you want to stay in line because you want to get there too. If somebody, you know, you see people sharing, oh, I got this on my iPhone, this application. Hey, I want it too. Even if they don't know what to do with it really right now, but they want it too. So we want to create this excitement. We want to create this share. To me, important is sharing. It's very important.
So the level of participation could be somebody who has, let's say, a backyard system to somebody that has a commercial operation. So you want them all to be kind of interacting with each other.
Yeah.
Yes,
everybody.
And also people that may be just reading about that. You know, I have some people who are in the publishing business or in journals. I mean, you see, we create many groups on Aquaculture Hub. org. So you have people who are students, you have people who are just interested in aquaponics, we have people who work on offshore, and we open also open access. This is a very important thing. I want to share also the information. I don't want to sell the IP to big publisher companies. I don't want to mention names, but I would pick up a fight on them. Mm-hmm. And the way I want to fight with them is just to give everybody equal opportunity to use the data. We're getting, I mean, most researchers in the world getting the money from the public through the governments to do research. And then, because they are being forced of getting their promotion via certain journals or publication, then they are bound to it, and then they give everything to a big company, publisher company, that eventually takes all the IP, and if you need it, if the university need it, they need to pay again. So mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense. I say, I want to give all the publication for free. If there is a poor researcher in Tanzania, he should get the information. If there is a farmer wants to have the information, he doesn't have to pay the university or publisher the rights to see any data that we provide.
Kind of definitely an open source model to kind of education here. Now, Sam, I'm curious what the next frontier is on the technological front for spreading the word about these programs. Now, iPhone app, that sounds very trendy, mm-hmm. but there are other mobile platforms, for example. Second Life is, you know, still chugging along, but there are other 3D, you know, worlds and environments that people are trying to build. A local company, Blue Mars,
right.
thinks that they have the revolutionary new answer to a revolutionary new three-dimensional world. So what's the next step for you as the geek in this program?
I think there's a couple of immediate things. One, you know, we're very excited about the Android platform in that this allows, you know, a lot more openness beyond the iPhone. We're looking at actually using converted Android phones to kind of be put out there and serve as data monitoring stations for doing you know, monitoring of aquafarms in a cheap way. You know, at the moment, we're just collecting data on locations. Ultimately, we want to have, you know, telemetry from all of these aquafarms around the world and be using that to say, as the temperatures go up here and this doesn't seem to be affecting the fish and the output's going down. So, you know, there's all of those streams of data that we'd like to see. On the virtual side, you know, Blue Mars is very exciting. We, you know, looking at that, and I've been talking with the Blue Mars people, and it looks fantastic. I think often people say, you know, Blue Mars, that's the replacement for Second Life. I think ultimately all of these things are going to be one big virtual engine on the end in the same way that the web is. And we're kind of like in the pre-HTTP /HTML phase, you know, of the virtual world. But ultimately they're all going to come together. And I, you know, in contradiction with what some people are saying, they're saying, oh, you know, that virtual stuff, it's the wrong way to go. It's mobile and social. It's exciting. I think mobile and social, neo-geographic, virtual, they are all one thing. Ultimately, the longer-term vision is, you know, I'm walking down the street and built into my glasses or my contact lenses a thing showing me, here's the local aquafarm. Here's the data feed coming in from the local aquafarm or whatever it is that I happen to. There's a series of different layers.
Augmented reality.
Exactly, that I can pull in at different times. And really, that's, you know, the virtual world is meshed seamlessly with social and mobile real world.
But right now, for right this present, where you want to go for information on all of this is aquaculturehub.org.
That's the one.
And there's a lot of interesting things. So you're going to have to keep in touch with us and let us know when this iPhone app is going to be available.
Sure will.
So we can let everybody else know. Thanks, Benny Ron and Sam Joseph for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Please join us next week when we'll talk with Aaron Kaplan and Sherry Miyasato about the Virtual Reality Treatment Center.
If you miss any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. Or if you have any comments or suggestions, email us at feedback@bitemarkscafe.org. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at @BiteMarks.
And I'm at @Hawaii. Our engineer is Lillian Song, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
We close with our song pick of the week. Here's Houses with a song called Circles and Squares. See you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.
All your dirty secrets, but that hasn't made a difference in the least.
about you.